Ken Murray, MD, is a former clinical assistant professor of family medicine at the University of Southern California. He's written a really beautiful article called How Doctors Choose to Die. And he makes the point often it's by opting out of life-prolonging treatment. And Dr. Ken Murray joins me this morning. Lovely to have you on the show.
Good morning, Alex.
Now, why did you write this article?
Well, it's actually something that I had been observing in my own practice for a number of years, and the community of physicians in which I had practiced. And I had noticed that physicians who died, they didn't die in the hospital like most of our patients do. And this is something I'd observed over time, and I had discussed with a number of my colleagues that, gosh, this seemed a little odd. And so I was actually solicited to write an article on end-of-life issues, and I told them, you know, I think I have an interesting story to tell about that. And that's how it came to be.
Yeah, it's... I think in surveys, Dr. Murray, Australians say, you know, when it comes to dying, yes, and we've all got to go sometime, they want to die at home.
I think that's true of most people. Yeah. I mean, the same is true in the United States.
So tell me what you dug into, and you have found that often your medical colleagues tend to be fairly serene when they're faced with death themselves.
Well, I think it's something that we have dealt with so much. Typically, a physician who is in that position themselves has probably been practicing for 30 years or more, and they've probably seen many hundreds of patients pass away. So they've had the chance to form an opinion about how does it work out reasonably well and how does it work out poorly. So it's really, I think it's an experience issue more than anything else.
Yeah, it's an issue that doctors can't dodge. The rest of us, it's only when it becomes very close to us with loved ones and friends or ourselves. But doctors are dealing with this all the time.
That's exactly right. It's not something that you can avoid.
You write in your article that doctors, when they are told, okay, you have a terminal illness, they know exactly what is going to happen. They know the choices, and they generally have access to any sort of medical care they could want, but they go gently.
Yes. You know, I don't mean to give people the impression, and some people do, that when a physician gets cancer that they just automatically give up. That's certainly not true. But there comes a point in any disease where you've exhausted all the reasonable options and there really is nothing left that isn't going to be extremely difficult on the person who's involved. And physicians understand from personal experience where those points are. And at those points, and I won't say it's always true, but I will say much more likely at that point they will choose to say enough, let me spend my time with my family and not in the hospital, and let's have a go at this in the gentle.
Because often part of this story too is the pressure from families, and it can often be the children of the parent dying saying, and then the parent goes, oh, I've got to stay alive for as long as possible for them. Do doctors come back with expertise, though, and say, look, I know what I'm faced with here. You've got to respect my choice.
Well, I think that's part of it. I think also there, for a doctor's family, I think they have to endure the conversation for all of our lives, because this is certainly one of the most profoundly affecting things that doctors deal with is people dying, as you can well imagine. Mm. And so it really affects us, particularly people that we have had in our practices for a number of years and we've gotten to know very well. They're friends in many cases. And so it really affects us when we lose somebody in that situation. And so naturally, when we come home, we talk about it. And it certainly ends up being something that I'm sure our family and friends probably start to think we're pretty gloomy people at some point because we keep talking about this. But it's
better out than in, I think, Dr. Murray.
well, probably so. And it makes it pretty easy for people to know what it is that we think about what we want done to ourselves. And I don't think there's much guesswork involved. That's certainly not true for people who aren't physicians.
You give the example of Charlie in your a respected specialist in your article. Can you just tell us about Charlie?
Charlie was just a great guy. He was very respected in our medical community. He was an orthopedic surgeon who pioneered a number of special procedures that are still used today, and participated in the 1936 Olympics. He had to take a boat to Berlin and back to America. So he was quite an achiever, and he was a fellow like reminded you of a Harvard professor because he spoke like one, and he was from Harvard, wore a bow tie, and came across very professorial. But it was remarkable when his time came, and what happened was he discovered a lump in his abdomen. He went to a surgeon that we all know and who took him to the operating room and diagnosed right there on the table that what he had was a disease called pancreatic cancer, which remains one of the worst types of cancers that a person can have. The treatment at the time, and we're talking 25 years ago, was a surgical procedure, which is the biggest procedure that we do in medicine. It takes 8 hours or so, and one person in five doesn't live to get off the table, at least at that point in time. So we're not talking about a trivial approach. Every person who survives is diabetic. They have all kinds of medical problems caused by the surgery, and their lives are generally pretty miserable. And Charlie knew all this. And so when he got the diagnosis, he made the decision on the spot that he didn't want the surgery, he didn't want any other treatment, and he went home. He closed his practice, he went home and spent his time with his family. He never set foot in hospital again.
It's an incredible story, and actually it's a bit of a familiar story to us because we lost a beloved breast cancer surgeon last year to pancreatic cancer. And again, he immediately closed his surgery and went home to his family. I think he had minimal treatment, but it's a familiar story. Sad one.
But unfortunately, the average patient, the average family, they don't know what's involved with the therapy. And so you present them with therapy, and I really have to feel for them because they don't understand. So it sort of comes across, do we save mom or do we kill her? And, you know, how can anybody answer a question like that?
Oh, that's an extraordinary way to put it. But
yeah.
Do you save mom or do you kill her?
And oftentimes when the families sit down to have that discussion, that is exactly the way it's phrased. I have seen this happen so many times, that particularly when there's a dispute among family members about what should happen, then those kinds of statements start to get made. It's incredibly hurtful and difficult to deal with.
And actually, a friend passed this article to a friend, to her sister, and they lost their mother at too early an age. And she got quite angry reading it and going, yes, mum was put through all that chemo, all those treatments, and we could have just spent more time with her.
You know, that's the thing, is that it's hard to conceive of the alternatives. I also described in my article my own relative who came home to live.
Oh, yes, Jack. No, this was Torch, your older cousin.
And he went through the same decision making process, and he got all the alternatives. He had lung cancer that had gone to his brain and other places in his body, And he chose to get no therapy at all, but that was completely his decision. I really didn't try to influence him in any way. And instead, what he did was he came home to live with me, and we spent 8 months or so basically doing all kinds of things that he wanted to do. And for the most part, he felt great during that whole time. The alternative would have been he would have been going to the hospital virtually every day for radiation therapy. He would have had to have all kinds of blood tests. He would have had a lot of side effects, and he probably would have been fairly miserable. As it was, he gained a lot of weight, and which is kind of unusual if you think about it for cancer patients.
Does that say something about your cooking, Dr. Murray?
I'm not sure I want to go there, but but he certainly enjoyed his time, and you know, until his last 3 days when he lapsed into a coma. He basically had no problems. So I look at that and I say, you know, we all have to die, but if you do, then that's the way to go.
Did he die at home?
He did.
As you say, he was your older cousin. Is that one of the most, you know, the thing that you could do for a relative? Is that something that you're really proud of?
Absolutely. I really feel like I did right by him.
Yeah. I've got a few. Dr. Ken Murray is with me, former clinical assistant professor of family medicine at the University of Southern California. He's written this really interesting article, which I think we found it from The Guardian, Ken Murray, but it's been published in a few places, How Doctors Choose to Die. I've got a message on Facebook from Matthias Schmidt saying, "My mother is choosing not to treat her cancer. Instead, managing the pain and maximising time spent with her grandchildren. She's a nurse and always told her sons that when her time comes, it comes, and that she would never want to experience the prolonging of the inevitable or go through the loss of dignity experienced by the many people she cared for."
Yeah, and I have to tell you, although I wrote my article about doctors who I feel I can talk about, being one, my actual experience is that nurses are even more militant about this than doctors are. I haven't seen any studies on it, and it's not an area I've really researched. Mm. But my own personal experience is that nurses are even more feeling of going the way of serenity and death with dignity, even than doctors are.
Well, they get to know their patients really well, don't they?
Absolutely. Mm.
Do you, I suppose, doctors have that duty to offer every treatment, don't you? I mean, that is something that you must do.
Yes, I think there's a moral and ethical obligation to do that, yes.
And so then that throws it back on the person and their families to make those decisions.
It is, but I think where the disconnect is in the way. Well, there are two problems. One is how we talk about it, and we, of course, are technically trained people. We have a jargon that we use, and there's a good reason for having the jargon. It allows very precise communication between physicians. But when we try to communicate things to people who are not physicians, we unfortunately tend to still use our jargon, which is not very meaningful. So we may talk about, well, we're going to use this treatment and it has a 50% response rate. Well, that sounds really good, but what does response mean? Does that mean that some lab test changes? Does it mean that you live a year longer? And there's a big difference between those two things. Mm. But to a scientist, there may be very little difference. It depends just on what you're looking at, but it matters tremendously to a patient, and we may not be very good at communicating that.
Yeah, you talk about doctors playing an enabling role.
And part of that is we feed into sometimes the concepts by the way we phrase things. And so people think that we're going to wave a magic wand and make people all better. And unless we're really clear and really blunt about what we say, we tend to feed into that. Oh, sure, we'll do that, and we'll make her feel better. Because we want to be hopeful. You don't like to dash people's hope and be gloomy. But I think you have to be honest also.
Dr. Kemmery, Marilyn has phoned, and she asked the questions, what about Alzheimer's patients who have no quality of life, yet you know are being kept alive, is the way she's putting it?
Well, this becomes one of the most difficult things, I think. The one good thing about it is the patient doesn't know. I mean, they literally don't understand what's going on. So I really must say that the people who are suffering the most in those scenarios are not the patient. It's all the rest of us who deal with that patient. So that's one thing that I think is important to keep in mind. However, certainly there's little quality of life with advanced Alzheimer's disease, and I think this is something that we haven't solved, how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. But one thing that I think is probably very important in that is how aggressive do we want to be with a patient like that when something starts to intervene, which is a natural process, which would ultimately lead to their death. For example, an Alzheimer's patient who develops a cancer of some sort that's going to require very significant therapy. They may not understand, but they understand pain, and they understand discomfort. And so in the process of treating the cancer, we can make their life truly terrible. And how much more time we will gain by doing that may be very questionable. So that's a situation where I think aggressive treatment of problems that then come up, which inevitably they always do, really has to be thought through very carefully.
Another caller, Trish, who says she's 70, and she said she looked after her mother as she was dying. She's called to say she wants to get "Do Not Resuscitate" tattooed on her left breast.
Well, you know, people do that now. And, gosh, it's probably 25 years ago when I met the first person who I knew had done that. And interestingly enough, it was an emergency department nurse who had done that, and which probably taught you as much as you need to know about what her experience was.
Would something like that have any legal standing?
No, it doesn't. But I will tell you that, generally speaking, I think you can do things in an aggressive way or in a non-aggressive way. And I think that a staff in an emergency department, when they observe something like that, would tend to be much less aggressive in what they were doing.
Mm. Because you give the example of Jack, 78-year-old Jack, and he didn't die as he hoped.
Yeah. This was really a tragic situation, and it still haunts me to some degree, although it's been quite a few years. He was a fellow who came into my practice, he and his wife, and they were elderly at that time. And Jack had told me that whatever happened, he never wanted to be placed on a ventilator or a respirator, breathing machine, as we call them, because he had been put on them many times in his life, and he just found it to be absolute torture. And so he made me promise I would never put him on such a machine. And I carefully wrote this in my office notes, and he and his wife were really pleasant patients. I took care of them for several years. And one day I came in, I had been off for the weekend, and a colleague had taken call for me, and I discovered that he had a massive stroke. He had been brought by the paramedics to the emergency department, and of course they put a tube down into his lungs and put him on a breathing machine. So I went to the hospital, and in fact found that that was his state, and he had had a massive stroke. There was really just no possibility that he was going to recover to any meaningful quality of life anyway. And but, of course, the worst thing is, here he is in a coma on this machine that he never wanted to be on. So I talked with his wife and brought in the notes from my office, placed them on the chart, and I turned off the ventilator and sat there with him for the 45 minutes or so that it took for him to die. And so he passed the way that he wanted to. I felt very good about following his wishes. Mm. But as I wrote in the piece, there was an unexpected part to it, which was one of the nurses felt that I had done something wrong and reported me to the police for a possible homicide, which I found out about only afterwards. There nothing came of it, but it just shows you how emotion-laden the entire mm-hmm. thing is.
Underlines the need to make living wills and make these wishes known and have these discussions with your family. There's a tweet here, Dr. Murray, before I let you go, from Sonia saying, "We had doctors on both sides of the fence when deciding to treat our then 20-month-old daughter 8 years ago. Horrible, horrible time. We still may live to regret our decision to treat and try to extend her life. She will suffer great pain in the future."
Yeah, these have got to be the most difficult things is with younger patients. Because, and I think it's because we relate to them so much better. And we feel protective of them automatically. And I think these are the very toughest decisions. And I think no matter what happens, I think the parents always feel some guilt, no matter what they do.
And Dr. Kim Murray, have you thought about your own death?
Oh, of course. How could I not?
like the rest of us, want to die at home with your loved ones?
Absolutely, and I've made this clear to my doctor, and my my lawyer, and my friends and my colleagues. There's nobody who doesn't know what I want done, so I've made that very very clear.
You haven't got any tattoos anywhere?
No tattoos, but I don't think I need them.
but look, as I think, fascinating that doctors. I suppose you have access to all that knowledge about the choices that we have, and then, as you're saying, many opt out of life prolonging procedures, and it's a really interesting conversation to have. I thank you for starting it for us.
Oh, my pleasure, Alex. Thank you.